You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a beautiful January day in Davis.
It is spectacularly sunny and clear here, and that has been the case for the first roughly 15 days of January. We're recording this broadcast on the morning of January 15th to go out on the air January 16th. It's late morning and it's 46 degrees here on my farm. And this morning it was 33 degrees and there was frost everywhere. I have had frost, visible frost out here. Every morning for the last 8 days, I've been taking pictures of it. It's actually pretty cool, pun intended. The weather for this coming week, we're going to go up to a high of 60 degrees today, 35 degrees tonight, more frost and possibly fog, usually in one or the other, not both, but it does happen. Day of the broadcast, 60 degrees. Thursday night, 36 degrees and clear frost again. Friday morning, 57 degrees. Friday night, 36 degrees, mostly clear. Saturday, 57 degrees. Saturday night, mostly clear, 36 degrees. You notice the pattern here is virtually unchanged all week. So it's going to be about 56 on Sunday, 56 on Monday, which is a holiday for many people, 54 on Tuesday, areas of frost every night with low temperatures around 34 to 36 degrees. And I had to discuss this with a person the other day. So let's explain something. How can there be frost when the air temperature is 36 degrees? The surface temperature that you see the frost on was lower than 36 degrees. You get frost on a surface when the surface has lost heat to the sky. If you had a little thermometer on that blade of grass, it would be about 31.5 degrees at the point at which frost occurs. So we're having frost every night. Not enough to be concerned about. It's January. These are normal, but we've had frost almost every morning through the month of January. Why? Because we haven't had rain at all. It has been dry here in the Sacramento Valley and all over California, regrettably. I do want to start the show. When these things are happening elsewhere in the country that are just dramatic and horrific, we don't want you to think we aren't aware of them. And so for those of you who are Southern California listeners, please be aware that we're aware. We know what's going on. This is a terrible, terrible fire down in Altadena, Los Angeles area. I know that area well. We've never seen anything like this before. We really hope you all can get back to your lives as soon as possible. And it's still ongoing as we speak. I mean, this is not going to end quickly. So we just want to acknowledge what's going on so we don't seem indifferent and callous. Everybody down there, please, you know, stay safe. And we can only hope that these winds die down. What we've been seeing here is the dry Santa Ana winds. And up here in Northern California, when they're happening down there, we typically have similar winds. And with respect to our own weather, it's been very dry. These low humidities, you got to do some watering in January, which I don't normally say. But yes, if you have a lawn, it's probably ready for at least one cycle of irrigation because we haven't had anything to penetrate the top few inches of soil. So the grass would probably benefit from that. More to the point, if you're buying roses at nurseries now, buying fruit trees at nurseries right now and planting them, it's great. The soil's workable, which for the last couple El Nino years has not been the case. January was just plain too muddy to plant. Well, people are planting. People are buying fruit trees. They're buying rose bushes and things like that. Water them thoroughly at the time of planting. Our old rule, check daily water as needed, is certainly in force. You won't need to water daily. Water use by plants is not that high right now, and these are plants that are basically dormant. But the soil, when you've broken it and made a hole and planted something in there, is going to dry out faster than nearby soil. And so you need to check it. You just need to keep an eye on it and perhaps give another soaking. My experience with things I have planted over the last 2 weeks, I've only had to water them twice, about once a week, a good thorough watering, a few gallons of water. But I am concerned because this is so different than the last couple of years. We've got out of El Nino. We're officially in La Nina. We're in a dry pattern. We have no rainfall on the horizon. Nothing in the 10-day forecast showing any rainfall here. You probably need to water those plants really thoroughly about once a week. Having said that, over the years, I have adopted another strategy at times where I have a drip system on them and I just turn it on every day to give them a little bit of water. It's not what I used to recommend, but I found with bare root plants, that actually works fine as well. Whichever you prefer to do, just remember there's going to be a crucial moment 2, 4, 6 weeks from now when those little white root hairs start to come out of those bare roots and into the surrounding soil, and they won't do it if that soil is dry. So if we continue in this dry pattern and you've planted bare root, go ahead and water about once a week or every day, if that's easier for you with a drip system, whatever works. There's always that crucial period when we get a dry north wind in early February. I wake up and go, oh, bare root plants are failing all over the valley right now because they need a little bit of water. So keep that in mind. It looks like nothing in the extended forecast in terms of rainfall, much of this 60 degree temperature going right forward for about 10 days. And chilling hours are finally accumulating again. We had a kind of a gap there around the end of December, early January. Fruit trees should get what they need this year. Striking difference in chilling hours in town versus out in the country. 450 chilling hours in Davis, 600 plus in Dixon out in the outlying areas. Fruit tree growers are fine in town. Might be a little marginal this year, but generally speaking, we're finding as long as they get that early chilling in the fall and continue to get some through January, everything seems to be okay. I think we're on track with that. And again, the reservoirs are above average for this time of year.
Now, Don mentioned watering daily, and I can just hear some of our listeners going, oh, no, 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 you can't water daily. You'll get Phytophthora. No, no, no. Phytophthora needs heat.
Yeah.
Remember that. So yeah. The fact that it rains every day or that you water every day in the winter, it's not going to do anything about the Phytophthora.
Yeah, and the only reason for doing that would be insurance. You don't need to do that, but we've had, in the last 15 years, we've had two very profound droughts here that lasted 3 to 4 years each. And we would be selling fruit trees, and one of those years we had zero rainfall in January, much as we're on track to have this year. And we found, you know, if we don't tell people something different than what we used to say, you know, plant, water once, don't worry about it until they bud out, was standard advice on bare root from the 80s and 90s. Then we began to find that you're going to go 30 plus days without rainfall. You better go ahead and do another watering or something that just keeps it evenly moist around the roots as they're beginning to bud out. We don't know exactly when they bud out, but I can tell you the bare root season, as we call it, then we get in the trees, the roots are bare, the plants are dormant. We put them in shavings at the nursery, water those shavings every day to keep the roots moist. It's getting shorter and shorter every year. So they come in this year. We got them right before the 1st of January. I'm looking at the trees. My guess is we will have to start potting the first of them, the plums, which are usually the first to start budding out about the 1st of February. And, you know, that means that what used to be a 6 to 8 week bare root season is now a 4 to 5 week bare root season. Roses come into nurseries, bare root already budding. When the boxes were open last year, when they finally arrived, they're already growing. And so there was no bare root season for roses, and there isn't going to be. You're not going to find places that take them bare root and put them in bins and sell them to you still dormant, because they won't still be dormant. I just took some lovely pictures of roses out on my field. They look really nice right now. Some of them are blooming. So, and people say, what should I do? Should I prune my roses? They're still blooming. Yes, prune them. They're not going to stop blooming, and they're not going to go dormant like you might have remembered from 30 years ago. The warmer winter temperatures, the temperature patterns that we're getting, any roses with China rose parentage simply don't go dormant. I mean, it's a nice bonus to have pictures of roses in December and January, but it does get a little confusing when you were told, prune the roses when they're dormant. Well, prune them anyway.
Longtime listeners may have remembered that I have a plum tree, which some years has huge quantities of fruit on it, much more than I and my entire neighborhood could use. And so I called Joe Schwartz. Now, Joe is the manager for Community Harvest of Davis. It used to be called Village Harvest. You may remember that from years ago. It's a nonprofit organization run entirely by volunteers, and it harvests fruit from residential trees and donates it to agencies that feed people in need. So if you have a fruit tree and you know you're not going to be able to use that fruit or don't want to go out there and harvest anymore, feel free to give them a call. Joe Schwartz, here's the email address, info at harvestdavis.org.
There is a website as well. It's just harvestdavis.org. So that's locally in the Davis area. Great organization. They come out, they take all the fruit, they give you a receipt. I guess you can write off the, you know, maybe tax deductible or something like that. More to the point, you're sending, I don't know, a couple hundred pounds of plums and mandarins to the local food bank. It's great. Here at KDRT, we actually have a program that I want to bring to your attention. We like to mention some of the other programs that are on the air. It's called Next Gen Talks. Next Gen Talks is a youth-driven program that offers a fresh perspective on local politics, features interviews with city officials, community leaders. It's hosted by Jasmine Garcia, a high school junior with extensive experience in local government. The program highlights issues that matter most to young people, public safety, housing, education, and by focusing on the local actions that shape the future for youth, Next Gen Talks aims to bridge the gap between young citizens and their city leaders, fostering a more engaged and informed community. It's live Fridays, 5 to 5:30 p.m. So check out Next Gen Talks here at KDRT Friday afternoons.
Well, we have an amazing collection of messages in our mailbox this week, and I am astonished at how far afield this little show on this little radio station gets. So let's start with Andrew. Dear Lois and Don, I am writing from North Texas.
Yep.
And my average frost dates are similar, if not earlier than your own. On last week's episode, January 9th, Don mentioned starting eggplant and pepper seeds together before tomato seeds. The timing of this doesn't add up to me. If tomato plants go outside 4 to 6 weeks earlier than peppers, am I supposed to start pepper seeds 2 to 4 weeks earlier than tomatoes? Could you walk me through when nursery eggplant and pepper plants are grown? I have reasonable luck growing peppers, but yields are low, and I wouldn't win any contests. The best success I've had growing eggplant, despite many seasons of trying, were from one start we picked up at a garden store 10 years ago. I love your show. It's appointment listening every week. Thanks for all you do. Signed, Andy.
What a great term, appointment listening. Well, yes, we've learned this the hard way. Peppers in particular germinate reasonably quickly as long as the soil temperature is warm. They really do need high temperature to germinate. So that's the first issue a lot of people run into. We use heating pads to start them at our garden center. And we do them indoors. We have lights over them, but that's not absolutely essential, obviously, for the germination portion. And I'm told that commercial growers actually start their eggplants at up to 80 degree temperature because they really, really need heat to germinate. That's all fine. It's pretty easy to get them to sprout. And then they stall. They come up, you get this, the cotyledon leaves, you get perhaps your first set of true leaves, and then they just sit there. And they grow far, far more slowly than tomato seedlings do. And eggplants are kind of intermediate in between them. So if we plant tomatoes in January, they'll come up right away and they don't slow down at all. They just start growing and stretching. And in fact, they get very leggy, as many people will find, unless we quickly move them to higher light intensity or out into one of our greenhouses, which are not heated. They're only passively heated by the sun. And we make sure they get air movement so that they thicken up. And we can go from seed to selling a seedling in 6 weeks with tomatoes, as little as 4 weeks when we get later into the season. But it takes 10 weeks to get peppers to a saleable size. In fact, even longer some years if we don't have a lot of sunlight. So we start peppers mid to late January, 1st of February, sometimes, and we continue on into February and March because we're going to be selling them right on through the season. So this is retail explanation, not what you'd be doing necessarily in your garden. You only want one crop. We want multiple crops. But those plants that we start in January will be saleable in mid-April. 12 weeks later. Plants of tomatoes that we start in March are saleable in mid-April, 6 weeks later. So the big difference in the timing is this much slower early growth rate of the pepper seedlings. But everything we've done, we've tried very, very light dilute fertilizer solution. That helps. Once you have the true leaves, we give them a very, very light solution of an organic fertilizer. And that helps some to get them greener and growing faster, but not that much. Temperature seems to be the biggest factor, but also they just have this period in which they stall. And if you've ever grown tomatoes, they don't do that. that. They are usually, you know, you start them in January, they're going to be 3 feet tall by the time it's actually appropriate time to put them in the ground. So that's the big difference, is the growth rate of the seedlings. And you can test this yourself. Go ahead and try some. Indoors, you probably will be in the 70s, depends on what temperature you keep your house at. They should be in the warmest place in your house for the germination period. The brightest light they can get as soon as they break the soil and start to come up, get them in the brightest light you have. I strongly recommend getting a simple grow light set up for seedlings of peppers and eggplant. Fine for tomatoes as well, but for these guys especially. These new grow lights, by the way, are so simple. I mean, you can get a grow light bulb that goes in a normal desktop lamp fixture and put it a few inches over the seedlings. That's all you need. If you have a great sunny window, I have a south facing window that works very well. But when I've used a different room of the house, I just set one of these desktop things over them to help them along. That does make a big difference. Eggplants are a little faster, but not that much. Tomatoes, they don't slow down at all. They come up, they just reach for the sky. And the biggest problem people generally have with tomato plants that they start early is they're just monster plants. That's okay. Follow the Davis Garden Show rule, keep them moving into a bigger pot. If they're in a 3-inch pot and it's not time to put them in the ground, move them to a 1-gallon container.
So it sounds to me as though peppers and eggplants, when you finally put them in the ground, they're going in at the same level as the pot they came out of. So you're not, the ground level is ground level when you transplant those. But in tomatoes, you can bury half the plant and you're fine.
Yeah, peppers, you know, people ask me all the time, is it okay to drop peppers in deeper? I do it, and I've never had a problem with it. But tomatoes will put out adventitious roots at every node. Adventitious roots are those that emerge in an unusual place. So, for example, from the base of a leaf, a root that comes out is called an adventitious root. Tomatoes do that very reliably. And I know I can do it. They'll root out. You'll get a nice deep-rooted plant that way. You're correct. Peppers are usually not that tall when you plant them anyway. And we don't generally recommend burying the stems. Again, I've done it. It's not a huge problem, but we're not doing it intentionally as we do with the tomato plants. That's correct.
So we have another listener in a distance, and this is Gordon from Montreal, Canada.
Here we go. We're international.
Oh, yeah. Good morning. I have this plant I purchased a few years ago. It's called Giant Grenadilla, a type of passion flower. The first year I had it, it was fine. It grew 20 feet.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They're very, 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 very vigorous.
Okay. I brought it indoors and it survived the winter. And I put it out last summer and it developed all these spots on the leaves. They didn't fall off, but all of the leaves from the previous year are covered in these different spots. The new ones are growing in and are clean, no spots. I'm wondering what the problem might be. There's no obvious sign of insects, so I'm guessing possibly a nutrient deficient.
It looks like thrips injury. In our area, that's what I would guess right away, because western flower thrips are a big problem here in the Sacramento Valley, and they attack the foliage of plants early in the season. They tend to move off the grasses into our gardens and onto our fruit trees, and they have a feeding mechanism that causes this kind of mottling on the leaf. Looking at the pictures, that's what it appears to be. However, I will say that just straight environmental injury can occur as well. When you move and that kind of burnt look, that kind of slightly almost mottled, scorched look can come when you have taken a plant, grown it inside, move it out into the sun, and the leaf was thin because of the indoor conditions. You move it into more sun and it just causes some environmental damage. Generally speaking, it is not harmful to the plant. It just grows out of it, so I wouldn't worry about it too much. Thrips are very difficult to control. If you happen to have thrips problem in your area, I've just gotten used to them. It's a very small insect that flies in, it feeds, it has a rasping mouth part, so it causes this kind of scurfy injury both on leaves and on the fruit of some things. It does a lot of injury to nectarines in our area, for example, and can damage tomatoes, although usually the damage is not really particularly noticeable. And you'd have to spray constantly. So if you think you have thrips, you might want to read about where they overwinter in Canada. Not sure what the answer to that would be. I know what the answer is here. I know what the answer is there. Here it's on the winter grasses, and you don't have winter grasses there. So that would be the first thing, is find out what their life cycle is. And you may, you know, people do oil sprays for them. But the good news is, Passion fruit vines are extremely vigorous, as you have found. They'll come back from almost anything as long as they aren't completely killed by cold weather. So I wouldn't worry too much about what you're seeing on the leaves there. My guess is the new growth will come on just fine. Whenever it is, you can move that plant back outside and you'll get sufficient vigor that, you know, this is a minor cosmetic thing. It's not really hurting the plant all that much. Could be thrips, could be environmental injury.
So I'm looking closely at this picture. And if it were thrips, wouldn't it be more scattered? Wouldn't it be more where the thrip did it? Because this looks like it's a uniform thing over the entire leaf. And I'm thinking that it's just because it came inside and it didn't like it inside.
That's like, well, it doesn't, it's not that it doesn't like it. It causes anatomical change to the leaf that makes a thinner protective coating. And then the leaf goes back outside and suddenly that protective coating isn't adequate. But the new leaves that come out will have that. So it's not all that harmful to the plant. Thrips damage can be severe. Anybody gardening locally can tell you sometimes we just get like every leaf affected. A lot of citrus in this area will show thrips injury on the new growth at various times of year. All of my young mandarins have it. I'm not worried about it because it doesn't really hurt them. They're still photosynthesizing. It doesn't hurt the fruit. It may cause some cosmetic injury to the fruit. If I were spraying, I would use oil. I mean, I would just use a light oil of some kind because that's surprisingly effective on them. Even including neem, although slightly thicker oils would probably be more effective. Any of you out there thinking of growing passion fruit? It's a subtropical plant. USDA Zone 10 is actually where it's considered hardy to. If you're listening locally, Passiflora edulis, the fruiting passion flower, passion fruit, do grow here in our USDA Zone 9, Sunset Zone 14, but they are just barely hardy. So if we get unusually cold, they'll be injured. In a normal winter, they'll discolor. They'll often get this kind of leaf appearance, a little different, more of a sort of a burnt look because of cold weather, but they come back. They almost always resprout from either the stem or the ground, and they will grow vigorously. 10, 20 feet in a season is no problem for a fruiting or flowering Passiflora, and they will fruit here. So it is something you can certainly grow in our area without having to worry about frost protection, except perhaps the very first winter when you plant it. Obviously, if you're listening in anything colder than USDA Zone 9, you would want to either bring it in or figure out some way to protect it because it's not going to go down below 30, 29, 28 degrees more than a few times without very serious injury. But we can do them here. And the other thing to note, 20 foot in one season, it's a very, very vigorous vine and very attractive, except the winter appearance can be rough.
Are they prunable?
You can prune them. Yes. And actually, yes, they're one of those kind of soft vines. They're vigorous, but it's not like a wisteria or a grape where you have a big woody plant that needs a substantial structure. It's just a vigorous, leafy, herbaceous plant, and it holds on with tendrils. So all you need is a fence or a trellis or something. This is our area. And if it's getting overgrown, you can go out with hedge shears and cut it back to the fence or the structure. You're not going to hurt it by doing that. Wouldn't be a bad idea. You get really overgrown, you might start getting roof rats and things harboring in there. So it's one of those kind of vines, like a jasmine or a morning glory. It's not a big woody vine that needs a structure. Very easy to grow, but plan for the amount of space. At least one whole panel of fence in your backyard if you're planting something like this in the backyard. And it's very attractive. All through the summer, the flowers are really cool. They draw the big xylocopa. Carpenter bees absolutely love them. Hummingbirds visit them. I'm not sure for what, but they certainly do go to Passiflora flowers. And if you're in this area, you will probably be visited by the Gulf fritillary butterfly. And don't be surprised if you're growing a passion flower or a passion fruit and something starts eating the foliage. If you come in and ask me what to do about it, I will say, enjoy it. You're harboring butterflies.
All right. Here's a second question from Gordon in Montreal. It's about my lime plant. How do you know when limes are ripe?
That's a good question.
The plant is growing in a pot and has several fruit. A couple of them recently fell off. They're both quite firm, but one is more yellow than the other. He sent a picture, thank you. He also sent a picture of the plant. Mm-hmm. So how do you tell when limes are ripe? You're going to have to cut it open, aren't you?
The calendar is a good starting point. Limes generally start to ripen here in the winter. Almost all citrus fruit start to ripen in the winter. Then the key question is, what happens to them after they go into the ripening process? Some of them turn color. Mexican lime or bartender's lime, which is the tender one. We don't sell that at our nursery because it's actually too tender to grow in USDA Zone 9. It's just a Southern California plant. That one doesn't really even turn yellow except for a very long time. It just gets slowly sweeter. That's the classic lime many people are looking for. We sell the Bears, B-E-A-R-S-S. Bears or Persian lime, which is hardy enough to grow here and turns yellow when it's fully ripe. And that confuses people. They think it's a lemon, but it's actually a lime. The flavor is a lime. It doesn't taste like a lemon, but it does turn yellow. You can go by the calendar is the first simple answer. Basically, January is when typically they start to be ripe and they hang on the tree on into the spring. So you can leave them on there if they don't fall off on their own. That's another indicator. When a fruit falls off, it's a suggestion that the, unless the tree was stressed, it's a suggestion that the fruit is ripe. I just went out to my blood oranges and I generally start picking them sometime in January and about 30 or 40 of them were on the ground. That one drops when they're ripe. Good news, they're still good when they're on the ground. So I took them in and gave them away at my nursery. So blood oranges, I go by when they start to fall. But the calendar is a good starting point. And January is typically when you do start harvesting limes and you can continue harvesting them February, March. And the good news is, like Meyer lemon, many limes will hold their fruit well into the summer. They still have good sugar content. They still have reasonably high acidity, which we expect in a lime or a lemon. And so they're still good quality if they're hanging on the tree, even into May or June.
Are these the kind of fruit that once they're separated from the tree, they continue to ripen, no, or do these stop?
Well, the simple answer to that is that citrus are not climacteric fruit. They don't ripen in the sense that a tomato does. You know, we have, or banana, we have stages of ripening that you can predict and manage. However, if you look at the data, the testing and sampling data for different citrus, you will find the longer they hang on the tree, even past their typical period, and even when you take them off the tree, the soluble solids content will go up a bit. The sugar, soluble solids, are, which is what they measure, primarily sugars in the plant, and they will increase a bit. They'll go from, let's say, 11 degrees Brix to 12 or 13 degrees Brix. They will get somewhat sweeter. So they do sweeten a bit after harvest, possibly because they're just dehydrating a little bit, so it's concentrating more. And in general, this doesn't matter to most people, but it is true that some of them will get a little sweeter. And this is an important aspect of the sumo mandarin, the big one that looks like a gigantic Owari satsuma that came on the market. We've probably been talking about it on the show for 15 years when it first showed up. Can I grow the sumo? No, there's no budwood out there. Well, you can now. You can actually buy trees of that mandarin. It'll be called Decapon or Shiranui, not sumo. Sumo is a trademark name. The thing about that that made it unique is they pick them carefully and they store them for a certain number of weeks and they watch, they measure as the degree Brix goes up from 11 or 12 to 13 or 14. So it's sweeter. Then they send them to market. They wait until they sweeten more before they send them to market. So they could market it as the sweetest mandarin you've ever had. So we're not calling that climacteric, but it is true that the sugar content of citrus does increase a bit after you harvest them. It's just that it's not enough for us to really consider that a marketable characteristic. I know that's a complicated answer, but sugar, there are physiological changes in any fruit, even ones that we don't call climacteric. Climacteric fruits are the ones where we have very predictable patterns, and we actually use that, especially agribusiness uses that, to know exactly when to pick so they can get you a good banana in the grocery store that was in Ecuador 2 weeks ago.
All right, so in our mailbag, we have a message from John in Fair Oaks. Hi, Don and Lois. I have a problem area in my yard, which I hope you can help me with. I've got a very narrow garden along the west-facing wall of my entry courtyard. This has hot afternoon sun in midsummer and deep shade in winter, and a varying amount of sun in between. I'm tired of swapping annuals out twice a year and would like to go with something more permanent. I'm having a hard time finding shrubs or perennials that can take this wide range of variation in light and which will fit into the 18-inch depth. 18 inches, wow. Because of their visibility, the plants should be evergreen and some seasonal color would be nice, as it's a bit, as would a bit of height to soften the tall wall. I realize I may have to compromise here, but I'm willing to experiment. And thank you for any suggestions. Now, John sent us three pictures, and I'm going to describe them to the listeners because it's very important. So the first picture shows just a wall with a sidewalk, and the gap between the wall and the sidewalk is 18 inches wide and probably, oh, 10 feet long or something like that. There is concrete on both ends, a patio and a walkway, and so this is an isolated thing next to the wall. Then I look at the next picture, and what I see now is I can see from the street looking into the entry of their house. They have beautiful, beautiful dark red doors, double doors in there, and an entryway with a little seat and things. The sidewalk goes right up to it. On the left, I see a lovely landscaped area. It has I would call it a faux stream. It has small rocks outlined with bigger rocks. And then outside of that, there are little bushes and things like that. There's a tree in front that is overshadowing a little bit. And on the right-hand side is where that 18-inch strip is. And it's skinny. And then the third picture that John sent, which now I understand what he's talking about. He's looking out from his living room through floor-to-ceiling windows onto the landscaped area with the plants and things, and then you see the sidewalk, and then you see that little strip, and you see the wall. Now, from this view, I can see that close in on this area, he does have a trellis, which means he can trellis things. He could do that. So, talking about what plants could go in that little 18-inch strip. The sidewalk is there, and if anyone is a broad-shouldered person or is carrying a box or something, anything you planted in there would basically be run into by
It
whoever's
could.
planted
Well, this is it's a very narrow bed, and this is I'll say this is the reason Nandina domestica is such a popular plant in California, is that it will grow in situations like that. That's the heavenly bamboo. But there's people that are kind of tired of that one. I will mention it because it will take sun or shade. I would be curious about the intensity of the sun, because this is between two walls, so it gets overhead sun, but it doesn't get west sun like all afternoon. So I'll mention Nandina, and there's a bunch of fruitless varieties out there. There's a bunch of dwarf varieties out there, Harbor Dwarf. There's several that would certainly work. But as an alternative to Nandina, because people are kind of tired of Nandina domestica, Mahonias exist. Many of them have very scratchy leaves, so be very careful about planting our native Mahonia, for example, Mahonia aquifolium, which is native here in coastal zones of California, which is a very, very pretty plant. I love it very much, but the leaves are scratchy. But there's some new Mahonias that have come on the market, and they've been given names that tell you they don't bite. Soft Caress is one of the varieties. Okay, that's one of them. There's another one. In fact, I could post a picture of one of my Mahonias. And the reason I thought of this after reading this is I've been taking pictures of this plant in full bloom since about the week before Christmas. Mahonias bloom mid-winter, so they are very cool, and they can take sun, but they can also take shade. Mine is in total shade, but I have also seen Mahonia, including these new ones, in the kind of sun you're describing here. Now, I would not in Davis put a Mahonia in 5 o'clock afternoon sun, or I would test it, and I wouldn't put in a whole wall of them until I see how well the one does. But they have a leathery leaf, shiny, attractive, bright yellow flowers, midwinter. Say they all have these kind of candelabra-like blooms that are very, very pretty. They start blooming in late December and they bloom through January. And again, if you don't mind the slightly scratchy leaves, our native one is a great plant, especially Mahonia aquifolium compacta, which is just a seedling strain of Mahonia aquifolium that stays tighter. So it's a more compact grower. It could be easily kept in that bed. The berries that follow the blooms are very attractive to songbirds. They are edible, just for the record, although rather astringent. The birds do seem to like them. And it's just a tough, tough, tough plant. On my own property, I've used Jacobinia, which is sometimes sold under the name Justicia, Brazilian plume flower, in a very similar situation. And that my plant is 35 years old, so it's gone through just about everything the weather can dish out here. That has a pink flower. Interestingly, I actually could take a picture of it in bloom right now, but I don't generally promise that it's blooming in January. It's been a weird year. Generally speaking, it's more of a spring and fall bloomer. So that's Brazilian plume flower. So that's one possibility. And that gives blooms at different seasons of the year. If it's not too hot sun, you could put one of Lois's favorite plants in there.
Abutilon.
Abutilon. And there's a bunch of types of abutilon now. And if I were doing a narrow bed like that, I would look for some of the new ones that are being sold in quart pots in the bedding plant section of most garden centers that get about 2 to 3 feet tall. And they have these lovely, more flared flowers than the older types, which are a little more downward petals. And they are very attractive plants that basically bloom all the time. And if it weren't too much sun, I'd have a cane begonia in there because I collect cane begonias and that looks like it might be a good spot for one, but I'd have to see whether it's too much sun for that. So you're going to have to play around with this a little bit. I have similar situations where it's almost all shade except direct overhead sun for 2 hours in the early afternoon. I have found with trial and error, many plants that I consider shade plants are fine with that. I've even had ferns in that situation, that 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock sun doesn't burn them. Or if it does, it's just a quick cosmetic thing and it's not that big an issue. So I've used the Sertomium fern, the holly leaf fern, very successfully in that kind of exposure. And it's a fern that does, it looks more like an accent plant. It has a very different leaf than most ferns. Takes it very well. Woodwardia fern, the California native, upright grower, so it would probably fit in there and do well. There's a lot of different things you could try, but starting with that Mahonia for a kind of an anchor plant, a Gulf Stream Nandina, if you want the color change of the foliage and the texture change on that one, that's a fruitless form of Nandina, only grows to about 3 feet tall. That could be a nice corner plant to stick it where people are likely to brush against the plant. That would be a nicer one because it wouldn't be a problem for either the person or the plant. So that's a possibility. And then there are plenty of perennials that would work in that situation as well. But let's get some backbone plants in there first. And the Mahonia, these new ones, are ones to look at if you need the height, because some of them, like this one that I've mentioned, get 4 to 5 feet tall.
I would go a different route with this. Having seen the beautiful trellis that they have in this other picture, mm-hmm. I would build a trellis all the way down that area.
There you go.
And because the structure of the trellis is so pretty, it's a well-designed and it looks good. You paint it the same color as the wall and it's just a great, and then you get the shadows and everything. And then you can put in front of it either something that's viney or something that you espalier. And so you could have the tallest of tall abutilons, the Texas Red, which is a huge plant.
Yeah,
and
that's
the
a big
flowers
one.
Flowers are the color of your door. I mean, they would match beautifully. And so you could take that and just tie it up against the trellis and then below it have some of the newer abutilon that Don was talking about that are compact and have lots and lots and lots and lots.
We're going to do a whole bed of abutilon. Is that what we're going to do?
Well, I don't see why not. I mean, it's pretty and it's lovely. Anyway,
right, and I would
think about a trellis.
I would add that mix. I would add Fuchsia triphylla, which has been sold under a couple of different names. There are cultivars of it. One has got the name Gartenmeister Bonstad. It's sometimes called the sun fuchsia. I have found it can take considerably more sun than a lot of other fuchsias. By the way, I would probably have that bed full of fuchsias anyway, but I would just because I really enjoy them and they do really well here in the valley. If you're listening to us on the coast, you already know that fuchsia mites have essentially devastated fuchsia cultivation all up and down the coast of California. If you're thinking fuchsias, talk to your nursery about the ones that are at least supposedly mite resistant. The mite doesn't overwinter here in the valley. It cannot establish itself. So I've done great with fuchsias. And the Fuchsia triphylla, which is the firecracker fuchsia, is extremely adaptable and gets about 3 feet tall. It does freeze back some years. This year, it's been blooming literally right through the winter with no problem whatsoever. So it will do that. It can bloom right on through even cold weather. If we get down into the mid-20s, the tops of mine defoliate and they come right back. So that's a plant that could anchor in there and bring in hummingbirds and could give you bloom essentially year round. I will promise you March through October, and sometimes you're lucky and get November through February as well. I'm going to throw one other plant out at you because this one is commonly sold as an espalier, and you can, meaning trained already onto a flat trellis, and you can even buy them that way, or you can do it yourself. You'll have to search around for it. Lavender starflower, Gruia caffra. And it's a shrub. It's one of these sprawling woody plants that we tie up and pretend it's a vine. It doesn't hold itself up until you've tied it up for a while, then it'll take that position. So you can espalier it. You can train it in a formal pattern, or you can just plant it in front of that really nice trellis, let it grow, tie up the parts you want, cut off the parts that are coming out towards the path, and it will bloom for a very long time. Basically, it's always in bloom. Gruia, G-R-E-W-I-A, Caffra, C-A-F-F-R-A. And in that same category are the new cultivars of Tecoma stands. Tecomeria capensis has been around for a long time. Common name of Tecomeria capensis is Cape honeysuckle. The Cape part is fine. It's from South Africa. Honeysuckle, it's not a honeysuckle at all. It's actually in the trumpet vine group. Hummingbirds love them. So that's the original. It's a big plant, 20 feet up. You'd have to tie it up all the time. But these new variants of the Tecoma stands, which is closely related, are from a Southwestern American native. They've been hybridized. The British just fell in love with them. And now there's a bunch of new varieties on the market. And it's basically a great big shrub to 6 feet that falls over. So we solve that by tying it up. We tie it up or we prune it back hard. Take your pick. You can prune it all the time and it still blooms because it blooms on new growth. Or you can tie it up and make it more like an espalier or like a trellis, like a vine. And it'll bloom. There's yellow, orange and dark orangey red at this point, and new colors keep coming out. Very drought tolerant, very adaptable, should be fine with the sun, and also will bloom in partial shade. So that's the Tecoma, T-E-C-O-M-A, stands. And, you know, Tecomeria capensis would work too, but it's a more rangy, it's a lot more like the abutilon. You'll have to do more work to have it be an attractive plant, but all of them will bloom pretty much, pretty consistently, and all of these are very attractive to hummingbirds. Also, I'm going to throw one more out there. Okay, just a minute. I've grown this vine and it lasts 4 or 5 years and then dies. So that's the problem with it. But it's still in that 4 to 5 years is a very lovely little plant. Salia heterophylla, Australian bluebell creeper. We used to sell a lot of them at our nursery because they were great for the shade or the sun. And they were very adaptable and they're slow growers. They're nice leafy things. They have these really pretty little blue bell shaped flowers. Our experience has been that they, as I say, 3, 4, 5 years, then the plant just sort of up and dies. So it's a short-lived vine, but it's a very, very good vine for small areas. So if, as long as you don't mind, you know, putting it in, letting it grow, letting these other things get bigger, then probably taking it out, consider that one as well. Australian bluebell creeper would be a nice contrast, and it would be easy to keep it in this narrow bed. So I would fill that bed myself with fuchsias and begonias, and I'd see how they do. But a bunch of these other woodier plants might be more to your liking. Gruia caffra, Tecoma stands, Tecomeria capensis, abutilon. That's going to be a very lovely tropical entryway.
And, you know, if all else fails, if you've got a trellis there, you could plant a clematis.
Well, that's a good thing to add there in any event. So I would strongly suggest that clematis be stuck in anywhere you have a corner where they can scramble up behind these other things we're talking about. I have a clematis jackmanni in front of my house that is in, it's almost entirely shade now, but it was in full morning sun when I first planted it 35 years ago. And it comes up sometime around mid-February, late February, and I have to make a quick decision where it's going to go, because clematis of this type, the deciduous types, your standard jackmanni hybrids, which you've generally cut to the ground in the winter, grow extremely rapidly when they come up. And oh, there's my fox. Hello, good to see you. Fox is visiting, saying hi through the door. Go on about your business. Okay, back to the clematis. Just walked up and looked at me. Hi there. Glad to have you around. And they grow 10, 15 feet in a matter of just a few weeks, like 8 weeks, 10 weeks. They go up whatever they're going to go up. At this point, I put a tomato cage. I have a 6-foot tomato cage that's a very sturdy one that I put over the clematis and stake it real securely. It completely covers the cage. It produces 300 or 400 blooms all at once in April, May, June. I'll find the pictures of it, and it's worth all the space it takes up when it does that, and the blooms go on for weeks. It's just amazing. However, it's a very light sort of open vine until it blooms. So clematis is, I'm always nervous when someone comes in and sees them blooming, I want this for my fence. Put it near another vine. put it so there's something else of substance there, like a Tacoma Stance or a Gruyere Caffre or even an Abutilon or some all of those. And then in the corner, stick the little clematis. And the first year, it won't do a whole lot. And the second year, you'll go, oh, that's a pretty little vine. And pretty soon, you realize, if I look at mine now, the root mass of this thing is 3 feet across. This 35-year-old clematis. It has spread out a bit from there, but the basically what you're growing is a giant herbaceous perennial vine. And you're going to plan for its annual growth, but give it enough room to scramble in up and onto other things. So the foliage itself is okay, but not all that attractive, but the bloom is absolutely worth it. So way down in one corner, the roots like to be shaded and the roots like to be moist. So this is important. Way down in one corner where you know there's a dripper right near it, plant the clematis and let it scramble through the other things, and it will be a spectacular display starting in about 3 years. Full sun for the tops is absolutely fine. The roots like to be lightly shaded, or you know, they do need adequate moisture.
Well, Don has he has lots of customers come in and talk to him, and one fellow comes in and says, you know, do more words.
Words, yes.
Or, you know, plant words and teach people. And so he gave Don a word, and the word for the day is Sciophilus, S-C-I-O-P-H-I-L-O-U-S, Sciophilus.
So someone who is Sciophilus would be a sciophile. First of all, we had to look up how to pronounce it. S-C-I-O, the C is apparently soft. So it's not Sciophilus, it's Sciophilus, thanks to the Oxford English Dictionary for that pronunciation guide. What does it mean, Lois?
Well, it means it's related to or denoting an organism, especially a plant, that thrives in or prefers shaded or low light environments. So it comes from two Greek words, scio means shadow and philos means loving. So a shadow loving plant is Sciophilus.
Yeah, so these are plants that love the shade, and we could do a whole show on that. I know there's a couple of folks out there that would love us to do so. Because they have almost entirely shade gardens, and sometimes they want to grow things like fruit and vegetables. Well, that's more of a challenge, but there's so many cool plants that are sciophiles, and I'm going to mention three. Asparagus myeri. Previous question was about a plant for the shade for a narrow bed. Asparagus myeri, the foxtail fern asparagus, would be a great choice. That would be a very dramatic plant. I have one that is nearly 40 years in the ground. 16 degrees, all the foliage froze. I thought, oh, that's dead. Nope, popped right back up. It's been years when I haven't watered it at all, and it's fine with that. And then when it gets watered, it just gets more lush and green. This is that kind of stiff, formal looking one. It's an accent plant. This is not this Asparagus springeri. I do not recommend that plant. It'll reseed all over your yard and your neighbor's yard, but this is related, but it doesn't reseed. That's a really cool accent plant. So that's one sciophile that I have done very well with. Campanula porcharskiana. Do you have that in your shade garden, Lois?
I do. I have I'm not sure which one.
Yeah, this is
the three campanulas that I got from the Arboretum years ago.
Campanula porcharskiana is the Serbian bellflower. Bellflower is the common name. And it's been an extremely successful ground cover for me in the shade. And it gives a really pretty blue flower for 4 or 5 weeks in the spring. The foliage is attractive. The only maintenance on it I've taken to doing is after the flowers are done, because they kind of sprawl all over the place, I'll take a leaf rake, just gently rake through it, pull off the old flower stems, and that's about it. And that one is a low-growing ground cover for the shade. I've also mentioned in the previous conversation the Fuchsia triphylla, which has done very well. And I'll go ahead and mention Viola odorata, because I have it in the shade, although I don't really suggest planting it for a bunch of reasons. But it's a very pretty plant. I just took a bunch of pictures of that blooming. It's blooming midwinter here. That's when it blooms here in the Sacramento Valley. Oxalis hirta. We spent a couple shows talking about the bad oxalis, the yellow flowered one, the sour grass, Bermuda buttercup. Don't plant that. In fact, do everything you can to get rid of it. But there are some very pretty oxalis that are not invasive. So I do feel we should give some equal time to this. Oxalis hirta, H-I-R-T-A, has really pretty light green shamrock-like leaves, a very, very dense growth habit. Nothing grows through it that's shorter than a foot. It really crowds things out, but it doesn't spread much. It's a bulb, but it just increases where it is. It doesn't run all over your yard the way the yellow Bermuda buttercup does. And this one happens to have a pink flower. So those are three sciophilus plants, three sciophiles that I have done well with under the shade of my sycamore tree. I had a related question on this topic, which was someone who had shade but wanted to grow roses, which is a challenge. Your common old hybrid tea roses are just not going to do well in shade. They want as much sun as possible, at least 4 to 6 hours of sun. But as with everything, there's a rose for every situation. There are thousands and thousands of varieties of roses, dozens, if not hundreds of species. And so if you want a rose that can take some shade, the Persian musk, the hybrid musk roses in general are shade tolerant. And there's one that's in that category, but not sold as if it's in that category because it sells markets better if they pretend it's a floribunda. Iceberg, regular old iceberg rose, the white iceberg rose. I finally went back through all the patent information to find out what its parentage was because it doesn't grow like a normal floribunda. It's not a tight cluster blooming shorter rose. It's a tall rose if you don't prune it. And I have one in the shade. Mine that I planted 30 years ago gets no direct sun. I've left it where it is. I've changed the landscaping all around it. There's birch trees and there's another tree over here. There's no direct sun on it. It's become a very lovely, informal, open habit plant that blooms all the time. Iceberg never stops blooming, has the classic semi-double flowers. And looking up the parentage, it's actually a hybrid musk. It's not actually a floribunda. It doesn't follow the common parentage of floribunda roses. But the company that introduced it in the 1950s, floribundas were catching on. The marketing on them was great. So they market that one as a floribunda. If you plant an iceberg rose in bright shade or just partial sun, it will become a lovely, informal, elegant plant that doesn't need to be pruned. It gets about 6 by 6 with a somewhat open growth habit, and it just blooms nonstop. It's in full bloom right now in January. So there are roses that'll even work in partial shade. And I'll throw one more out there, but please plan for space for this one. Cecil Bruner, climbing Cecil Bruner rose, the sweetheart rose, heavy spring bloom, doesn't rebloom in the summer, basically evergreen, not super, super thorny, although there are thorns, but more to the point, completely disease-free and will grow and bloom in the shade. But it's a big, vigorous vining or, you know, climbing rose. So give that plenty of space.
Well, we have another message. This is from Sharon in Tracy, California. Hi, Don and Lois. Thank you so much for your advice regarding weeds in decomposed granite. I'm excited to buy a hula hoop and attack my yard. I have a question about growing fruit in part shade. I have a small backyard, 14 foot by 30 foot, on the east side of our property. In the summer, it gets hot sun from about 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and in the winter, much less. I'd love to grow fruit back there, but I'm not sure what would work. I threw in an apricot tree and two cherry trees just to see what would happen. I have blueberries, huckleberries, and a lingonberry. I was considering planting in the raised bed and maybe a Passiflora edulis Frederick for the arch trellis. What do you think? I'd love any feedback or suggestions for plants that would work in my situation. The weirder, the better. I'm totally open to plants that need extra care or protection.
I love the idea of the weirder, the better. Well, I'm looking at huckleberries and a lingonberry, and you're off to a good start with weirdness there. Huckleberries are not generally thought of as Sacramento Valley or Northern California plants in the interior whatsoever. Let me know how they do. Blueberries, yes, blueberries are fine. Although I'll tell you, blueberries actually fruit better in full sun, has been my experience. I've done them both in the shade and the sun, and I get better. The plants look better in partial shade, but the fruit yield is higher in full sun. However, thank you for the picture, because this is really important. I can see that this is fairly high shade. What Sharon has is a long row of Italian cypresses on one side of the fence, and the neighbors appear to have them as well. And it's a small yard. There's not a lot of space. So those Italian cypresses, this is very important, shade year round, whereas deciduous trees, at least you would have sunlight for some portion of the growth cycle of the plant. They've also been pruned up. So mainly what Sharon has is trunks at ground level and the shade is up higher. I can tell you what will happen with your, an apricot and two cherries. They'll just grow up into the light and that'll be fine. They'll make another secondary canopy over the rest of the garden. I don't want to be a downer, but do a little research on the spotted wing Drosophila, which is the reason that my nursery no longer sells cherry trees. And we have this conversation with people just about a daily basis during the fruit bare root season now. The worm that gets in the cherry fruit is a real hassle, and you have to spray a lot to have fruit that won't have worms in it. I will come back to one group of fruit that is something almost anyone listening to us can grow, and that is plums. Plums, and one of the reasons I like to mention them is there is a plum for every, if you're listening in North Dakota, there's a plum you can grow. Plums are very adaptable and easy to grow. When people come in and say, what's the easiest fruit tree? Well, they're not quite there. I would say persimmons, pomegranates, figs are so easy, you don't have to do anything at all to them. Plums, you should prune at some point because the fruit load will get to be more, you know, more and more each year. And if you 7 to 10 years without pruning, they'll start to fall apart. But that's about it. We don't really care how big the fruit are, so we're not really worried about fruit thinning. They don't really require any special spraying. Disease problems are not a problem here. Now, I do understand those of you living east of the Mississippi should ask locally about some disease problems that occur on plums back there. But they don't occur on every plum, and there's a lot of different kinds. We grow Japanese plums in our area, many introduced by Luther Burbank. They're not from Japan 100%, but that was part of the breeding. We also grow European plums, prune plums, as they're better known, European plum. The green gage is a European plum. They do very well here, and they do very well in a lot of different places. But even if you're in an area that's too far north or shaded or something, there are other types of plums that you can grow. In the far north, there are North American species that are very easy to grow. They aren't as popular because they're not freestone. They're a little harder to eat, but they have wonderful flavor. And almost any plum, whether it's a native species or a hybrid or one of the introduced cultivars that we all grow, will have good flavor. It's just a matter of whether they soften too quickly or whether they're a little more astringent or what, but they're all edible and they all make great jam, and they're very, very easy to grow, and they're relatively shade tolerant. So the other group would be berries, cane berries. Be careful where you plant them. Monitor to make sure they don't get away from you, or your backyard will be nothing but berries. But they do grow in a fair bit of shade and yield quite well as well. They yield better in full sun, but they're okay in some shade. So I would focus on cane berries and plums if you're looking for easy fruit. There's lots of other possibilities. This is a great open topic for us to pick up on a subsequent show. But those are the ones I would look at first. I would probably, hate to say this, take out those cherries and put in a plum or two.
Sharon, I have a request for you. I see in your picture a pole, which looks like it has a squirrel barrier on it. And I can't quite see the top of the thing, but that looks like a bird feeder. Would you tell us how that squirrel prevention on your bird feeder is working?
I'm going to throw out one more fruit. And yes, and if the squirrels are a problem, we have to have a whole nother conversation. But one of my favorite fruit for the shade is the alpine strawberry.
Oh, yeah.
Totally different than all these things we've been talking about. And you can grow these from seed. They're really easy from seed, by the way. They're slow, but it's very, very easy to do. You can buy them at garden centers. Usually they're in the herb section, you know, because they're grown by our herb suppliers. But they have little tiny fruit. It's only about a quarter the size of a regular strawberry, and it's intensely flavored. And there are a bunch of cultivars. There's a white one. There's some that are very sweet. There's some that are very, very productive. My experience with them is that they will reseed, so they'll become a lovely ground cover, actually. They're fine in a container, but they're also fine in the ground. They like shade. They start blooming as early as February, March. When I had a barrel of alpine strawberries, which I had for more than 10 years, And I could walk by that barrel any time of year between about March and November and pick a small handful of strawberries from them. It was completely full of alpine strawberries that I had grown from seed. So this is something, and by the way, this is an easy project for kids. They are very, very easy from seed. You can start them indoors January, February. Alpine strawberries, there's a bunch of cultivars. I highly recommend you get some of those into your mix as well.
Well, normally we end with a garden quote, but today I have a poem to read for you. This is by William Blake. To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.